are listening to Life Science Connect Radio, bringing you the latest news and showcasing both innovative products and services and the industry leaders making it happen. Life Science Connect Radio, bringing the life sciences to you. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Todd Youngblood.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Life Science Connect Radio. I am your host, Todd Schnick, joined by my friend and colleague, Todd Youngblood. Todd, we are just weeks away from New York City and Interphex 2014. So looking forward to getting there and broadcasting from this great event.
Yeah, I think going to the Big Apple is always fun, and having Interphex there just is going to add to the whole experience in a big, big way.
Yeah, well, based on what we're hearing, it's going to be a heck of an event. We're going to learn an awful lot. Well, leading up to Interphex, Life Science Connect Radio will be bringing you some great conversations from some fascinating industry leaders. Today's show is no exception, so let's get right to it. Say hello to our guests, Paul Melamud. He is the Director of Facilities, Utilities, Equipment Compliance, and Scott Collins, who's the Director of Laboratory Operations and Compliance with Q Pharma. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd and Todd.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, it's good to have you. Thanks for carving out a few minutes to join us. I appreciate that. Paul, I'm going to start with you. Give us a quick rundown about you and your background.
No problem. So my name is Paul, and I've been with Q Pharma for approximately 6 years. I'm the director here of all of our facilities, utilities, and equipment projects that we do for our clients. I've got experience with pharmaceutical industry from both the brand name and the generic part of the industry, as well as when we go to medical device and biotech. We've done everything from validation to regulatory services to quality projects.
Outstanding. Scott, give us a quick rundown on you and your background.
Sure. I've been with Q Pharma now almost 20 years. We're in our 20th year of existence. And I started out as a laboratory chemist in quality control, then moved over to quality assurance, and down into pharmaceutical production, and then got into validation around 91.
Outstanding. Todd, methinks these gentlemen have some valuable experience to share with us. Paul, before we dive into our discussion at hand today, take a quick sec. Give us the 10,000-foot view of Q Pharma. What do you guys do? How do you serve your market?
Yeah, so Q Pharma got its start as a compliance consulting and validation solutions company here on the East Coast in New Jersey, approximately 1994. So we've actually, as Scott said, celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. We do both commercial services and sales and marketing services for our clients, so we're not just a one-trick pony with validation or anything like that. We serve clients all over the life sciences industry, pharmaceutical, medical device, and biotech. And let's see, we have about 120 employees. We're here in Morristown in New Jersey, and we have consultants that are based all over the country as well in various regions, whether it's out in California or up in the Northeast, in the Midwest, things like that.
Scott, I'd like to just get a little bit more background. I've been around manufacturing businesses for my whole career and have a pretty good feel for what quality assurance is all about. But in the specific field of life sciences manufacturing, talk a little bit about what's different and what's more challenging and difficult.
Many companies continue to face challenges in that area, and one of the biggest causes is ineffective approach to planning. Rather than having a master plan and plan everything out from the top down, some firms continue to plan individual portions of a project as opposed to doing an overall master plan to begin with and then work it in from the top down. So they'll start at the bottom, immediately understanding and to them having clarification of what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, and just jump right into doing the work. Some companies will also fail to look beyond their three-year plan and take the necessary steps to accommodate their own growth. So they'll have clearly in mind what they want to accomplish for the next couple of years and then set themselves up for failure when they want to expand beyond that.
You know, walk the audience through why compliance, which is obviously how you guys spend your day and it's the important work that you're doing. Why does that matter? Why is that so important in what you're doing?
Well, the answer is the FDA enforces the compliance. It's the law that they have to follow. And, you know, we will come in and answer the questions that the FDA asks them. So if they don't properly follow the regulations and be compliant with the regulations, then the FDA will hit them with a finding, whether it be a 483 or a warning letter or a consent decree, and then we will help them interpret what the FDA is looking for and help them solve their own problems.
Well, one of the things also that I've noted over the course of my career is a lot of manufacturers will, in addition to buying new equipment when it's necessary, necessary. They'll often get equipment both in the production line and in the laboratory that's been used. Is that a bad idea, a good idea? It doesn't matter.
Well, I can answer that for you, Todd. I'm sure you've bought cars before, right? So I've owned plenty of perfectly good used cars, as well as new ones. But I'll tell you, the pitfalls are pretty much the same whether you're buying something that's used for pleasure or buying one for business purposes. One of the most common pitfalls related to equipment that we experience on our client projects is when purchase is usually urgent because management has decided that something needs to get done at a moment's notice, either because something broke and they can't make a product that's coming on back order, or maybe an expansion is suddenly critical and they didn't properly plan for it. So in order to accommodate the priority, they throw a lot of the good project practices out the window, things like critical requirements gathering and getting your expert technical folk to evaluate a piece of equipment. And when these get neglected, usually nobody thinks of them until after the piece of equipment's been purchased and brought on site. So you got to tell you, that kind of problem makes me think of something from recent memory. When we had an old blender at a client that was failing the calibration, and they had determined that its control system was pretty much shot. I mean, it was a pretty old blender at that point in time, and they couldn't really repair it, and they did have a product that was going on back order very quickly. So the site's production VP, who was no slouch, let me tell you, he was very well versed in all of these unit operations for manufacturing. He knew what he was doing. He went out and he said, I need to find this exact make and model of a blender. And as long as I find that, it's going to make my change control, it's going to make my validation activities much, much simpler. So he went and he did that. He found off-site somewhere, he found a blender that was the same model, and while they were waiting for this thing that he cut a quick PO for, they had to blow a wall out from the facility just to be able to get the thing in and install it. So when it was all said and done, when the dust literally settled, I think they spent about $100,000 just to get this thing plugged in without ever having, you know, laid eyes on it. It was really, really quickly thereafter when they first let the technical services folk come in that they realized that the drive was different and they had a number of other problems that basically told them they had to validate this thing from scratch. They couldn't get away with all the efficiencies they thought they were gathering. And I got to tell you, when we did our lessons learned on that project, what really came to pass was technical services turned around and said, the couple $100,000 we spent on this, we could have actually bought something new and got it done with the same amount of work in a quicker period of time and for less money. So I guess my lesson for that story is when you're looking at buying something used, you shouldn't throw the good project activities out the window. You really need to consider all of the things that make your process important and consider what make your product a proper quality, and then include that as part of your purchasing decision. Don't go out and do it rashly.
Well, let's take that a step further in terms of validation planning and execution. And I'd probably like to ask both of you to weigh in on this, but share some additional best practices that the industry ought to know about.
Well, the first thing would be to involve the entire team. A lot of places or a lot of companies, when they, especially in production, they want to buy a piece of equipment, they'll just go out, they'll look for it, and they'll purchase it and bring it in. They don't let quality know that quality needs to develop the validation documentation to validate the equipment or the system. Or they won't let IT know that they need to bring something online. So the best practice is involve the entire team while it's still in the concept phase so you can avoid a very costly pitfalls further down the road on that.
Paul, a little different spin on that same question. Talk a little bit about the most common problems, issues, and challenges you see popping up for your clients.
It's an interesting question in terms of what we see with our clients because everybody has a different experience. I think if I try to amalgamate all of the knowledge that we've got from the various projects we've been on, I think people changing their mind halfway through a project is probably one of the biggest things that you'll find as very common in the industry. For example, water systems, okay? I've seen plenty of water systems where they get designed and they know that they want to put a certain number of use points for certain pieces of equipment. And, you know, it takes several months to a year or more to buy the equipment and get it all laid out. And by that time, they've already got all these grand designs for different equipment and different use points. And so they just start throwing all these additional tie-ins to their system into the design. But not always are they going back and looking at how this affects the pumps and the motors and the pressures and the overall flow rates and how many things can we use at a single time. And, you know, they'll end up bottoming out the system or not being able to use as much of the system at one time as they expected because they didn't go back to the planning and do it all correctly. So I think to me that's one of the biggest challenges I see is you have all these people on these projects. Everybody's trying to do the right thing, try to get things done quickly, and sometimes we're just skipping out on these proper project approaches that we need to follow.
Well, you mentioned the FDA earlier in the broadcast. Talk about some of the current regulatory challenges that the industry is facing.
So by that, I'm assuming that you're talking about 483s and warning letters and things like that. So given that warning letters are already filtered down a version of 483s to what's really important and serious, I'm going to just talk about what we've seen as the trends in the 483s. The past year or so, and I think the FDA collates it from third quarter to third quarter, but over the past year, there were, I believe, 5,200 483s that the FDA had put together. About 45% of those were food, but when you look at the allied healthcare industries, 21 or so percent was devices, 18 to 20% were human drugs, biologics, and then the rest were things like veterinary drugs and other ancillary things that the FDA deals with. What shouldn't be surprising to your listeners, though, is that the trends of what the FDA finds for both devices and drugs are pretty similar. I went ahead and just grouped a couple things together here in my notes so that we don't go over 20 different versions of the same thing, but I would say that the top five citations for drugs and the top five citations for devices accommodate somewhere between 80 and 95% of all the findings. So the things that we have seen and that the FDA has echoed when you go through all of the data that they've compiled, our number one issue is procedures not being fully followed. A lot of companies put together procedures, and for one reason or another, people either think of improvements or think there are better ways of doing things, and this doesn't get quickly through the procedure creation process. So you end up having people doing things that are not written down. And the FDA considers that to be a very strong point of lack of control. Whose decision is it to make a change in the way you do something like that without it going through quality assurance and so forth, and where do you draw the line? So when the FDA sees things like that, it tends to be a big warning sign, and it is something that happens in a lot of different companies. Second most common thing that they tend to look at and cite people for are poor investigations of discrepancies, failures, and product complaints that come in from doctors and from people taking their drugs or using their devices. All right, and what this really boils down to is the concept of determining an actual root cause. We seem to be getting better at it as an industry, but there are still a lot of companies that I have been to where we've been brought in as subject matter experts because the people don't always know how to conduct a thorough investigation, or in some cases are actually afraid at finding out what skeletons people have been working very hard at keeping in the closet. Nobody wants them exposed, but once you understand what they are, you can work with the quality departments and figure out what kind of impact they have and really, really act to never let them come out of the closet again. So getting to the real root causes is something that's of very extreme interest to the FDA, because when the same problems keep coming up again and up again and up again, these are the kinds of things that turn your 483s into warning letters. It shows that you're not in control. Related to that would be the CAPA process, which is the third thing on my list here. The CAPA stands for corrective action and preventive action. And what that really is how do I fix the problem when it occurs? And then how do I prevent it from recurring? And that's tied right into that root cause analysis that I was just talking about. FDA expects you to not only get to that root cause and not only prevent it from recurring, or at least plan for it to be prevented, they want you to have an effectiveness review, and they expect that you have procedures that guide you through how you can verify that you really did prevent this problem from recurring, so that you don't have just an infrequent accident waiting to happen again in the future when it could really impact product. So to me, those are the top three, and they all really fall on this idea of not following procedures and having deviations. The fourth and final thing that I have on my list relates to more of the scientific soundness of things. And if you group them together, the FDA has cited both laboratory controls and process validation. They've been cited because they're either not following their own SOPs or their master plans on how to do validation or how to do certain analyses in the laboratories, but also sometimes that these validations that they draw conclusions out of don't scientifically support the conclusion that they say. And whether that's because of poor statistical design or whether that's because they tried to cut corners and ended up not being able to prove something, those are the kinds of things the FDA says, how are you saying you do good science when you don't have the documentation to support it? So I think that those four items are pretty much what summarized upwards of 90% of FDA's recent findings when it comes to doing inspections.
Taking a different perspective, let's assume for a moment that I'm a plant manager and I'm looking for some outside help, some vendor that can help me with my quality and compliance. What process should I use and what kind of decision criteria should I use in choosing a partner to help me do all that?
Experience is the key in art, as we've encountered throughout the years. You don't want a textbook validation or regulatory compliance person. They know what's written down, but they don't really know how to apply it. So you want someone who's actually experienced, if you can, find someone that's been out in the field experiencing it themselves. Who has worked in the pharmaceutical industry or medical device industry? Who has done what we are trying to do at this point in time and is now willing to share that experience and help us succeed in our goal? And the second thing, of course, you make sure you have to do is make sure they follow through with your supplier qualification process. Bringing someone like that in-house without following your own procedures would just lead to one of the 483s that Paul has just mentioned.
All right. Well, gentlemen, what I want to do before we wrap here is ask each of you to give me a quick read on some trends, some things that we should be keeping an eye on, what the industry should be paying attention to with regards to validation planning and execution and quality. Tell us what you think we should be paying attention to.
Okay, Todd, I'll start, and then Paul can add in with what he's experienced in the industry. For a little over a decade, the biggest focus has been on quality systems. The FDA will come in and they'll start, when they start an audit, they'll look for your quality manual, then your policies and procedures underneath that, and then any proof that you are following it. And that pretty much has been leading to a lot of the 43s that Paul had mentioned previously around having good quality systems in place, procedures, following your procedures, and proving that you have been following them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the quality systems approach is really where the trend has been. It's been that way for a few years, and it's only getting more and more that way. The way the 483s have been collated by FDA, the way they come in and start looking at, say, the quality management quality system, and then looking at one or more other quality systems, and then judging a company based on those and deciding if they need to look at other quality systems. So, for instance, you know, if you want to be ready for an inspection, your quality people should already be ready for what has changed since the last time the FDA has come in. What organizational charts? I want to see your deviation list. I want to see your, especially your critical ones. I want to see your complaints. I want to see any recalls. I want to see change controls. And I want to look at lists like that. And I'm going to start looking at them on a risk-based fashion. So I want to see the biggest impact types of things. I want you to start walking me through that documentation. And if I see that you've done the big ticket ones well, I'm going to have less worry about the other ones like the medium and the minor ones that don't really matter in terms of impact to patient, but do show that you have a robust and properly functioning system. So the more risk focus that you give to your internal audits to things like that, and the more you try to highlight these items, the more ready I think that you will be for an external audit. The FDA less cares about single individual findings as they do with how willing you are to respond to them, how readily you are able to respond to them, and that your systems are overall in compliance and in control. Because a system that's in control can at least give them the confidence they need to say that this company is able to make good product on a standard basis.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing those insights. I hate to say that we're about out of time. So before we let you go, how can people get in touch with you and learn more about the work you're doing out of Q Pharma? Scott, let's start with you.
Sure. They can reach us at qpharmacorp.com on the internet, and they're more than welcome to come to Morristown, New Jersey to visit us. We're on 22 South Street in Morristown, and our number is 973-656-0011.
All right. Outstanding. Well, gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to spend some time with you. Thank you so much for stopping by and joining us. I want to thank Paul Melamud, the Director of Facilities, Utilities, Equipment Compliance, and Scott Collins, the Director of Laboratory Operations and Compliance with Q Pharma. Paul, Scott, thanks again for joining us. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Todd.
All right. Well, that wraps today's show. We'll enjoy seeing you at Interphex in New York City, March 18th through March 20th, and you can catch Life Science Connect Radio broadcasting live from booth 1265. So on behalf of today's guests, Paul Melamud, Scott Collins, my co-host Todd Youngblood, I'm Todd Schnick. We'll see you soon on Life Science Connect Radio.